This episode is brought to you by the Women's Network.
To me, ambition does not only mean getting to the top of something. Ambition might be having a well-balanced life, doing something that you really enjoy doing while also being able to do things outside of work, like have a family or have personal interests or have hobbies that are just as important to you as work.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Redefining Ambition. I'm your host, Jamie Vinnick, founder and president of the Women's Network, the largest collegiate women's networking organization in the United States. Today, I am thrilled to introduce our next guest, Sam Saperstein. Sam is a managing director and the head of Women on the Move at JPMorgan Chase, taking this from an internal program to empower and advance female employees to a global initiative working to expand women-run businesses, improve women's financial health, and advance women's career growth. Sam's path has not been linear, and after graduating from Brown University, she began her career as a reporter before ultimately realizing that her interests lied elsewhere. After graduating from business school, Sam held leadership roles at McKinsey and PayPal before making the jump to JPMorgan Chase. In this episode, Sam highlights the key differences between sponsorship and mentorship, shares how her definition of success has evolved over time, and opens up about her career pivots. Sam is also the host of the Women on the Move podcast, which I encourage you to check out. Hope you enjoyed the episode and make sure to follow us on Instagram at thewomens.network and at Redefining Ambition. Sam, welcome to Redefining Ambition.
Thanks, Jamie. Great to be here.
So great to have you. And I'm so excited to talk to you about everything you have accomplished and advice. And I want to begin by learning more about where you grew up and any early influences before heading off to Brown University, where you grew up, what you thought you were interested in, and any early influences that might have had an impact on your career today.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So I grew up on Long Island, which is outside of New York City. So I think I was always associated with the city living so close, but definitely had a suburban upbringing and have really spent my early years, all my years really through college and graduate school on the East Coast. So everywhere from Boston down to Washington with stops in Providence, New York, Philadelphia. So I basically was an Amtrak girl, I guess, so to speak, kind of going up and down the coast, but I really enjoyed that. And probably my earliest influences, as for many people, were really from my family. So my father worked on Wall Street and was very involved in finance. And so while I didn't really think I would end up in finance, which is kind of ironic as I am, I think just seeing him go to work and talk about the things he was involved in always had an impact on me, probably in the back of my mind when it came to business and being interested in that. And my grandfather too, my grandfather worked till he was almost 91 years old. And so when I saw him as my role model, I thought, oh, I can't ever stop working because he didn't. So got to keep going. So those early family influences, being a professional and being, I think, in business probably had a lot to do with what I do today. And I went off to Brown thinking that I was a writer and I was going to do a lot in journalism. I did that before I went to college. I did a lot of media work in college and really expanded what I was doing from writing to the school newspaper, eventually working with the school's radio station, which was a middle market FM station, not just a campus AM station, but it really reached a million listeners throughout Rhode Island and Southern Massachusetts. But you'll love this. This was a alternative rock station. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist on the dial anymore, but it does exist online. It's WBRU. Great music. And I was one of the news junkies at the alternative radio station. So while all my friends were playing great music and were very cool, I was in the small little newsroom making news stories and reporting and going on the air. But it's something I really love doing. And so that really propelled me out of school thinking I was going to be a journalist at the time.
Wow. Okay. So when you're in college, were you someone who got to campus and was thinking, I need to be involved in million extracurricular activities, or were you someone who just kind of found things that worked for you? I think that a lot of people listening who are in college feel the pressure of having to involve themselves in a lot of different extracurriculars to take advantage of the opportunities, maximize their college experience. So what is your advice or even reflection in looking back on finding the right activities or extracurriculars on campus that align with your interests, but also allow for fun?
I think I probably took more risks academically, to be honest. So Brown happened to have no curriculum, no core curriculum for students. So once you picked your major, you had things to take, but until then you could really experiment. So I took a lot of different classes. I was a history major, but I took neuroscience and philosophy and biology and just all sorts of things, you know, not related to history. But when it came time to my outside activities, once I found first the newspaper and then WBRU, I went very deep in those. I would probably spend 20 to 30 hours a week on those activities. I mean, it was really like a part-time job and I loved it. And I think when you get really immersed in something, it, number one, doesn't feel like a job, but number two, in college can really set you up for leaving school because you see what you really enjoy doing and what you're good at. And I loved being on the air. I loved reporting. I loved, you know, making stories. And I did it so much that I also worked for media outlets outside of the radio station in the local market in Providence. So I worked for the Associated Press and I worked for a local television station. I basically just did anything I could to get an experience in journalism outside school. So I think my advice for students would be find what it is that you like doing. I mean, the first year or two, you might not know what that is. So cast that broad net, you know, get to know people and get to know really interesting clubs. And if there's not something that appeals to you, start one. I think it's so easy these days to start things and to find common groups that might really want to do things with you, whether they're at your school or not. Maybe you can start a network where you are interacting with colleges elsewhere and then just go really deep on that because that could be a career for you or a lifelong interest that you pursue.
Yeah, the women's network, yes. While you were in college, were you networking? Were you reaching out to people, trying to better understand the industry, or were you not necessarily engaging in those networking practices? I have a few friends who went to Brown, and it is very different than I would say where you went to graduate school, which we'll get into, just the culture and what it means to network and prioritizing things as such.
I think I did do a lot of that networking. I probably didn't realize it at the time, but it turns out I probably have 20 friends or so from college that still keep in touch today. And so that's an important part of your network. You know, you think it's just social at the time, but in reality, it takes you through life and really can help you over time. Not to mention they're just great friends. When I was in college also, I really looked at those summer internship opportunities as things that were important to do. And so my last summer in college, when I was a junior, I worked at CBS News. And I worked on a news magazine. It actually does not exist anymore. It was called Eye to Eye with Connie Chung, for all those who are interested in some history. But that was a really important professional network that I was starting to build with people at CBS News, because my thought was I could graduate and then go to work there after school. I never did that. And to be honest, the learning was I should have kept in touch with some of those folks long after I left there because that could have been helpful to me down the road. But I could see it back then as being an important launching pad because I had a nice summer, did well, and I think if I had wanted to go back there, I would have been able to. So I would say keep your eyes and ears open to the people around you, whether that's at school or your friends or those internship opportunities that you have. They're going to be really important to you over time. And by the way, it's so much easier to keep in touch with people than it's ever been, right? Get on LinkedIn, get on social media, send people emails from time to time. It's really not that hard to do.
How would you say, I mean, you're someone who's very busy, you get inundated with emails all the time. What is the best etiquette, at least over email, to keep in touch with someone? Is it a short email? Is it just updating you on their life? Is it sharing an article?
Yes, I love all those ideas. So short emails or through LinkedIn, I happen to use that platform. When people get in touch with me to let me know what they're up to, when they send me something that I might have missed or would be interested in, I love that. You know, it really shows a thoughtfulness that you're able to understand what that other person might want to read about or learn about. And it just keeps you informed. And I would say of so many women that I've met over the years, and not many people actually do that. So you would just stick out right away in a good way mm-hmm. by being one of those very few people that keep in touch with others. But I think make it short and make it useful. And that way too, when you want to get time with someone and you ask them for that, they're more likely to do that. And I would say when you ask for time for people, you know, make that quick as well, make it convenient. You know, people might not have time for an hour lunch or coffee, but even 20 minutes now by Zoom or a phone call, I think people would be open to doing that if you've kept up along the way.
And setting times in advance, sending a calendar invite, other things that can minimize time on the other person's plate. So you graduate, you begin your career in journalism. You went to Phillips Business Information. You were a business reporter at Dow Jones. Before you went to grad school, where you got your MBA at Wharton, what about the position interested you? I mean, you mentioned storytelling, but what drew you to journalism? And then what ultimately led you to pivot away from that and going to grad school?
So I really loved stories in business about businesses. How were businesses created? What were the motivations behind the people and the leaders at that business? And what problem were they trying to solve? I'm very fascinated by that today. And so I ended up in this newsletter publisher, my first job at a school, writing about the subject of technology transfer. Okay, I was a business major. I had no right to write about technology. I was not a technology person. But it was really the story about how technology is created in our government labs around the country. And then that technology is commercialized for private use. So it could be anything from night vision goggles. This was a story I wrote about where the military would use these goggles, you know, for military purposes, but all of a sudden they became binoculars for people who wanted to use them at night when they are in the woods hiking. You know, things like that, that were really cool stories about technology that I could relate to. And it was the first time I was really writing business stories for a business audience. And I really liked that. I thought that was really fascinating. That's what really carried my interest throughout the jobs that I had before business school. And that's what led me really to business school. I would also say that those early jobs, particularly at Dow Jones, where I was covering bond markets, the treasury, basically what was happening in our macro economy, it really required me to go back to school and teach myself certain things. Again, I was a history major. I didn't have an economics background. So I went to school at night. I took courses in Washington, D.C. and in New York. Really just at universities that had those adult ed ongoing education classes. So I did macro and microeconomics really to be a better writer and to really understand things that I hadn't learned in school. And it, for me, it was just very motivating to just be more knowledgeable about these subjects in a really easy way. You know, I didn't have to work that hard in these classes. It wasn't for grades that mattered. It was really just to fulfill and pursue my career ambition.
Wow. Okay. That's amazing to hear. So you go off to grad school. What is your opinion today on an MBA? I mean, you have an MBA, so of course you have a biased opinion on this, but do you, looking back, think you would still get your MBA? Was it, do you still find use in it? Is it the network that you find use out of it, out of the degree and the experience rather? Would you go back and did you find the experience to be helpful? And also, what was it like going back to grad school when you had all this experience now under your belt?
Grad school was such a different experience from undergrad. It was a much more focused professional environment, shorter, 2 years versus four. But everyone came in pretty much with a mission, which was to go deep on business, to learn something. And again, very career focused. For me, it was important because I really used it as a career changing pivot. Mm-hmm. Came in as a writer and journalist. I left as a business person. And those career changers among my class, I think really took almost maybe more out of the experience because we needed it to actually get to a different place. And I think the two things that were most helpful were number one, the content and the education, things that you learned. I was a strategy and marketing major. So for me, marketing, for example, became a great a toolkit that I use today. But the network too was definitely invaluable. The people that I met there, the friends that I made, people I tap today to further my career are all worth it. That is a very powerful alumni network when you go to graduate schools like that. But I don't think it's necessary for everyone. Mm. You know, business school can be very expensive. It's time that you're not working. And if you find yourself in a job where you're advancing anyway, you're learning, you feel like you have the right educational or just skills that you're developing, I don't think you necessarily have to take that leave and go to business school. Now, if you happen to be an employer that would cover that for you, either full-time or part-time at night, that's wonderful. And I think that's something to take advantage of. But I think if you feel like you're on the right track, you don't necessarily need it. But when you do go, I would say make the most of the network and the people that you're meeting there.
Mm. What was going through your head in terms of thinking about your level of confidence? You came in with this untraditional path, I'm sure, compared to others, and didn't necessarily have a similar background as some of, I'm sure, your peers who were coming in from vastly different industries and areas of interest, which is not a bad thing. I actually think it adds value to the class and to conversations I'm sure you had. But did you struggle at all to feel like I deserve to be here, or I'm going to achieve success in life, or I'm going to pivot into this new area that I don't necessarily have a ton of experience in, but I'm going to put my head down and learn a lot? I mean, what was going through your head at the time?
So coming in, there were certainly a lot of people who had business backgrounds as undergrads, or they worked on Wall Street and finance, for example. And by the way, I did too. I did a very brief stint in investment banking between two journalism jobs before I went to business school. So that probably made me feel confident that at least I knew what was going on and what they were doing. And maybe they had better Excel skills than I did, but I at least knew the drill that I could sort of do it. You know, the nice thing about business school is it's so project oriented these days. You work with teams. And so I felt like there was always something I could bring to a team, another perspective. So I could do the writing. I had some of the analytical background before. I didn't know everything, but I usually tried to find a place in the project that I could own and really bring my own perspective to it. And so I felt pretty good at it. You know, I also felt like I knew things like math. You know, I was a good math student even in high school, even though I didn't do it in college. And so the math they were teaching and statistics and other things, I felt like I could ramp up and learn it. But I would say for people who get intimidated by that sort of thing, there's always people to help you. You know, your professors are there for a reason. Make use of those times you have to see them after hours. Or your working group, your teammates, your peers are all there to really help you. Find the people you like to study with. I had a great friend who was into entrepreneurship, and he was very good at a lot of those topics I wasn't, but I was good at accounting because I had done one accounting class in college. So we would get together. I would tutor him in accounting and he would tutor me in the other things. And we had the greatest time together, you know, just sharing those skills back and forth and being able to be there for each other. He wasn't in my official study group. It was a friend I made outside, but he became a lifelong friend as well. So I would say, you know, Look for those people. And you remind me of another story in business school, which really is an example of understanding what your skill set might be over time. So it was orientation week. We hadn't even started yet. And one of the teachers had us take a Myers-Briggs personality test, which is one of many out there, but it's often used in business. And when we took the test, he pulled me aside and he said, "Do you mind if I put your results up just to talk about it to the class? I won't say your name." So I said, "Okay, that's fine." So he put my results up. And at that time, I was an ENFJ, which for Myers-Briggs people meant I was more extroverted, intuitive, a feeling person when it came to using facts, and I like things kind of more structured. So he puts on my profile and he says, "Well, this person really looks like they're going to be a people person. And I think a good job for them is in HR. And I'm listening to this thinking, I didn't go to business school to go into HR. I went in to do strategy and to do marketing. And now I felt very pigeonholed and I felt very nervous. And so I wasn't sure where this was going to go. Well, fast forward all these years later, I pretty much am in a very people-driven business doing diversity efforts with a lot of HR colleagues. And so it's really interesting to see how these things kind of come full circle. And maybe I ended up in a place that it really had suggested originally.
Wow. Okay. That's an amazing story.
You never know.
You never know. So you graduate and you go up to McKinsey, you're an engagement manager, and then you end up going to MasterCard before you get to JP Morgan Chase. I'm going to fast forward with your career a little bit. So in hopping around from these companies, you met and amassed this huge network, I'm sure. along the way, as you're climbing through the ranks, you're advancing in your career, I'm sure mentorship played a really important role in your life. I'm also sure that sponsorship probably also played a huge role in your life. What is the difference between the two? I think they're often very much conflated. And can you elaborate on the specific roles each played in your life and in your career?
Thank you. This is one of the most important questions, I think, for a career. And we talk a lot about this at JPMorgan Chase. So let's just make a very clear distinction between a mentor and a sponsor. A mentor is someone you can go to for advice, for guidance, for help on a coaching matter. It could be a peer, it could be a friend, it could be your parents, really just someone as a sounding board for you. And that could be a one-time instance, or over time, you talk to the same person. When we talk about a sponsor, we're really talking about an advocate, someone who's really pounding the table for you, who has power and influence in your organization to pull you into a new job or a stretch assignment. So think about that as someone who can actively do something to grow your career versus a mentor who you might go to for help from time to time. Very different roles. And you probably are going to have more mentors in the course of your career than sponsors. Sponsors are pretty unique and special, and people in positions of power can't sponsor everybody. There's just not enough top jobs to go around. So they themselves, as a sponsor, probably have fewer people. I think you need to look for both in the course of your career, but the sponsor in particular is going to be really critical as you advance through an organization and get to the very top. And when I think to the times where I've had both, probably earlier on in my career, there were more people around me acting as mentors. But the more senior you get, you're really in need of those sponsors to pull you up. And my current company, I feel like I have a really nice group of sponsors. They include managers, former managers and current managers of mine, who I keep in touch with to make sure that when I have a need or want to do something else or just want to talk about the future of my career, they're there to help me. And they're there really to help position me. So I would absolutely really encourage listeners to think about both of these roles very carefully and as soon as you can. You know, you might be in companies where you work with one boss, like many of us do, and maybe that person can be a mentor for you. Maybe not be a sponsor. Not all the time are managers going to be sponsors. But if you're in a company where you have project-based work, like in consulting or banking, where you might move to different types of projects and leaders, that's a wonderful way to get to know a range of people, and that you can really think about the relationships to develop over time.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. So when people hear this, that sounds great. They will look for more sponsors. How specifically would you identify a sponsor? I mean, you're meeting tons of people. Is it a connection where they were able to see your work ethic? Maybe you had a few conversations, you keep in touch. How do you cultivate that relationship, which is different from a mentor, keep in touch, but also identify them?
I think the sponsor relationships become apparent when you get to know somebody well. So if you're working with someone over a period of time, they really understand your work. They know your skill set, and they're helping you get better, by the way. They're giving you feedback. They're taking the feedback. So now it's a relationship that can build on itself over time. You will see that grow. You will see the people who are actively working with you, who keep asking for you, who keep putting you on next projects because you're doing such a good job. That is the nature of a sponsorship relationship at work and evolving. I don't think you have to go up to someone and say, "Will you be my sponsor?" It probably is a situation where you both are working so closely together and relying on each other, and you'll recognize that that's what's happening. And what I like to tell people too is, especially as a person coming out of school or in your early 20s, you don't have to shoot for the CEO or an executive at a company to be a sponsor. You can look at the people right above you to be your sponsor, because by the way, they're going to grow their career. And when they grow, they're going to pull you with them. Mm. So I would look immediately around you, even if they're junior too, just to see who can get to know your work and who you can evolve with over time.
That is great advice. I want to talk about diversity as well, and also how you feel like the industry and generally speaking, representation at all levels, including in senior positions of power, the C-suite, are evolving and changing. And you mentioned that it's a big priority of yours. You also work very closely on the topic. I know it's an interest of yours, I'm sure a passion as well. The numbers at the top are beginning to evolve and change, but they're not progressing in the ways in which numbers at the entry level, for example, more women than men are graduating from college, are being reflected and represented. And that's for a whole variety of reasons. What have you noticed has either begun to change or is maybe happening now that is contributing to more progression being made in terms of representation in positions of power, where more voices from diverse range of backgrounds will be heard?
Yes. I think things are certainly better than they've ever been in the past. They're better than they were, you know, 25 years ago when I left school. But they are making now smaller and more incremental gains. And it does feel like, even though at entry level programs and positions, things are about 50-50 men and women, we do see pretty much for all industries, women are, you know, 25-30% of senior level roles at the very top. So we see this narrowing of the pipeline to senior level roles everywhere. It's not only in one industry. And we know it's going to take a very long time and have a lot of effort to get to 50% still at senior level roles. And so, you know, what I would say to that is we have to keep going. I really encourage women to stay in the workforce and work as long as they can, even as their responsibilities at home tend to emerge. And by the way, they tend to emerge mid-career when you're really working hard to get to your next role and you're trying to stay, you know, progressing still in your career, and you start having family and, you know, they're all coming down at one time. But what I'd like to tell women is ask for the help you need. Keep going as long as you can. It's very hard to step out of the workforce and come back in at the same salary and at the same level. And it also is hard to come back in and know that some of your peers kept advancing while you are going to come back in at the level you left. And so I really would love women to stay in as long as they can, even though it's very, very hard. But to find the companies and the managers who can help you do that, who understand that you have other responsibilities, who understand and see your talent and want to grow it and give you the flexibility that you might need along the way. So I love seeing so many women graduate from college, go into all sorts of industries. I'd love to see more women go into STEM and finance. And that's what we try to do all the time here, is encourage that. But again, in those middle years, when it gets tough, you got to find the right supports for you. I think we're going to get there at those senior levels. You know, things have changed in that probably, you know, up until 10 or 15 years ago, when you had one woman or two women at the top, that's all there were going to be. And so by definition, women were fighting for very few roles and maybe competing against each other and not always helping each other because there's only going to be one or two. But that is changing. Obviously, we want more than one or two. We want 50% at the top. And so there's more to go around. And what I've seen over the course of my career is more women absolutely helping each other. I personally have benefited from a number of women mentors and sponsors over the years. I've never encountered a bad woman boss who really didn't want women to succeed. And I really don't see that very often anymore. I think women really are pulling together to help each other, particularly in industries where there's still few of us. And that makes me very encouraged.
I'm so glad you shared that. How would you say the conversations about diversity in the workplace today are different than they were even 5 years ago? And is there one thing in particular you feel that needs to change in order to create a more diversified workplace and make people feel welcomed and heard and valued in the culture? By the way, for the record, I have heard amazing things about Sam's leadership and managerial style through multiple people. So I wanted to add that as well.
Thank you. That's very kind. It's really different now. I mean, again, probably, I don't know, 10 years ago, we didn't really talk about diversity this way. We certainly didn't talk about inclusion. We might wanted to talk about having more diverse people in there, but that inclusion piece of whether people feel really valued and part of the company and able to share their ideas, that wasn't part of the conversation. So we've gotten to a much deeper and human place, which really allows people to sort of come in as they are. But we know there's still more to be done. You know, we know, for example, women of color, Black women still will come into work and feel like they can't be their full selves. They can't speak what they want to say. They can't show their true culture or certain parts of their background. And they have to do a lot of switching of that to not be fully who they are. That does still happen. And I think we all need to pay more attention to that for people overall. I would say the other thing is more companies now are really tracking both diversity in terms of representation and numbers and inclusion to a much stronger degree than we've ever seen. They're just more data driven about it. And when you start to see companies reporting this out, reporting it regularly, you know that they're really focused and they'll make a change. So if you're going out there looking for a job and want to be part of a company that cares about this, look and see if they report on those metrics. Look and see if they have a chief diversity officer in their organization and if they actually convey publicly that these are important goals for them.
I want to ask about reflecting on your career and where you are today. What would you tell your younger self who is just graduating college, who thinks she might know what she wants to do, and even graduating from your MBA program? What would you want your younger self to know?
I think it really goes back to that people equation and the sponsorship. So when I think back to jobs that I've had, while I feel like I've always made good relationships at those jobs, there were probably a few times where I could have been more deliberate early on about the sponsors that I was going after and really tried to solidify those relationships. So for example, early on in consulting, when that was my first job out of business school, the consulting model really relies on sponsorship relationships. You know, as a young consultant, you're being trained by everyone around you. You're being selected for projects. Sometimes you know you're being selected. Sometimes you don't. You don't necessarily know what they're saying behind closed doors on staffing. And that's probably the time where I would have been more deliberate in going deeper with people that I had good relationships with, but maybe I could have gone deeper and had better relationships and really approached them to do more work together. So I'd have that sponsorship relationship. I think it's always the relationships that you don't develop versus the ones you do that leave you feeling you could do more. And so for me, that's what I would say. And getting back to keeping in touch, I think I should have kept in touch with some people early on in my career and preserved that communication. I think I did a better job with that postgraduate school because I was a lot more focused on my career at that stage.
Hmm. Okay. Before we transition to our lightning round, I do want to ask about ambition. I mean, a huge theme of this podcast is about talking about, you know, ambition and what that means in many different capacities of your life. Women on the Move is something that you lead. It's an incredible initiative, and a huge theme to Women on the Move is ambition. And I'm curious how you would define your own version of ambition. What does ambition mean to you, and how has that evolved?
So our mission is to fuel female ambition. So I love this question. I think it really goes to the heart of what women want for their lives. And it can be very different things for different people. Some people want to be CEO. Some people want to run organizations, create their own companies, do something in a professional matter that gets them to the top of whatever it is that they're doing. And that's great. And I think we all recognize that ambition first. You know, anyone who wants to succeed and sort of be the best at what they do, we sort of see that as a very classic model. And frankly, I would say a model that a lot of men understand as well. But to me, ambition does not only mean getting to the top of something. Ambition might be having a well-balanced life, doing something that you really enjoy doing while also being able to do things outside of work, like have a family or have personal interests or have hobbies that are just as important to you as work. So for me, probably ambition changed over time. You know, early in my career and pre-children, it was, well, I just want to get the farthest I can or change roles and see how far I can go in a new industry since I was a changer. But probably having children, my ambition definitely morphed into, I want to be a great mother and wife and also career professional. So for me, ambition became, how can I do all those things to the degree that made me feel good? I'm not always going to be the best mother or the best career professional in one given day. Something always comes into conflict. But if I can balance those out and have a well-balanced life, that to me is success. And I probably learned this early on in pre-business school when I did work in investment banking. I was working very long hours, as one does in that industry, literally 24 hours a day, literally weekends. And that was not a sustainable life for me. So knowing that early on helped me in the future understand how I needed to guard my time and what I wanted for my time. So I love working. I could work, you know, my hours in the day, whatever, 8, 9 a.m., 5, 6 p.m. and be really on and great. But then I want to go home and I want to be with my kids and I want to have a life and I want to see them on the weekends. So ambition to me is balancing those out as best I can for them and for me.
Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so we're going to transition into our lightning round of questions. I'm going to ask you a question and let me know what pops in your head first word. So what are three things women and people can do to become more financially literate?
Okay, number one, understand what your goals might be. Do you want to get better at saving? Do you want to understand how to budget? Whatever it is, understand your goals first and foremost. Second, I would say use the tools that are available now to help you. And what I mean by that is there's all sorts of tools in the market to help you save. For example, at Chase, if you are a mobile customer, meaning you use your mobile app to do banking with us, there's a great feature in that app called AutoSave, which can automatically pull savings from a savings account or checking account into a savings account. And I would say those automated savings capabilities, wherever you are, whatever you use, are so important, especially early on, because if you can set it and forget it and just know that your money keeps going into savings, that's a great way to build good habits and to have money there when you need it later. And I think the third is, especially for women, you've got to stay engaged and you have to get to a certain level of financial literacy for your whole life. And what do I mean by that? So if you're a woman coming out of school, you know, you're in college now, you know, right now you're thinking about how do you budget your day to day? How do you manage your student debt if you had it? Or if you're working right now, how do you use that work salary to offset your costs? But your life will change over time and you need to keep building that financial literacy because you never know if one day you want to have a big purchase like a house, support a family, take on a different career, maybe with a lower salary. Maybe you get divorced, unfortunately. Maybe your spouse or partner, you know, doesn't live long and you're on your own one day. Think about the literacy you need to carry yourself through a lifetime. And you'll always keep learning. It's not like you need to know everything early on at a young age, but understand how you like to learn and what things work for you so that you can keep building on that over time.
What is a full circle moment now that you are very senior in your career and reflecting on what you've accomplished?
Well, as we started out, I used to be on the radio and really loved it. That might have been one of my favorite jobs and really didn't do that after I left college. But lo and behold, over the last few years, I've now had a podcast with JP Morgan Chase called Women on the Move, where I've talked to nearly 100 guests around their careers, leadership, entrepreneurship, financial health. And talking to guests for this format really, for me, feels like full circle, like back on the radio, like we used to do. Only it's even better because it's much more longer form and we can go really deep on stories like you and I are doing today. So you never know where those early experiences could take you or those early skills. And it just made me, you know, really happy and felt really good about being able to come and do the podcast.
And just to follow up, what is one of the best pieces of advice someone has shared on your podcast?
One of our guests on the podcast was Jean Case, who is the chairman of the Case Foundation and runs the board of the National Geographic Society. And Jean spent, you know, many years talking to people in all walks of life about being fearless. And she really talks about taking these risks, and especially for women, making that risk-taking kind of core to who you are. So you get very used to doing these things and knowing that if you don't take enough risks, you might not get as far as you could. So I keep thinking of Jean's kind of be fearless and take the risks kind of counsel, because I think it's just really important for women in particular to push themselves, to know that they can do more and to keep challenging society's expectations of what it is that we can do.
You touched on having a family, you have three kids. Since you had children, how has your definition of ambition and your approach to advancing in your career evolved or changed?
I would say it definitely did change over the course of having three children. When I had my first two, I took off for parental leave for each of them. I came back to work full time and I kept going. And I always told myself, just keep going until you literally can't anymore, until you fall on your face, can't do it. And I always knew there could be a moment that that might happen, but I just wanted to keep going and change things as I needed to. When I had my third child, that's where things got very complex, as people with multiple kids will tell you. And especially as they grew older, and we realized with our third child, he had special needs and we needed to really focus differently on him and give him more resources. That was a real moment for me where I had to step back and evaluate, how could I keep working? What could my work life look like in order to best meet the needs of this child? And that did coincide with doing different things at work, with taking on roles where I felt I had more flexibility in my day, where I could be in more control, where I could do the things I needed to do with him. And I would say that so many mothers face that. You never know when you're going to face that, by the way. You don't know what might happen with children you have in the future or family needs. And I think just to be very aware that that is fine and that's okay. And to prioritize your family is, I think, something we should all do. That requires a different change in how you approach your career. Don't beat yourself up over that. You know, take the time you need to, and then find the ways to re-ramp back up or get back in there. I'm not saying it's easy. It is definitely a struggle for me. And I constantly question whether I'm doing the right thing some days, but for the most part, I feel like it's been the right path. And I will also say this, you have to be comfortable dropping some balls. I can't tell you the number of times I sent one child to the wrong practice. I didn't have the birthday gift on time. My car is a complete mess. You know, something is not perfect in life, but you have to not strive for perfection right now. I like to tell myself, once and done, do something one time and do it and get it over with. And don't worry about it being perfect. You'll just never move on if you don't.
Love that. Thank you. What is a book you recommend everyone read?
One of the best books I've read in the last few years is Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. This is a really important book about race in the United States and about caste systems around the world. She talks about India, Germany, and the US and how there's actually a lot of similarities, sadly, between these cultures. And I think what it did for me is really point out just the legacy of racism in our country, how very long and entrenched it is and has been here, and the things that we can do to really address that now. So that's something that just made a big impact on me and written by a woman who I think is just brilliant. I'm reading another book right now that is also fascinating called Career and Family, and it's by Claudia Golden, who's a Harvard economist. And she looks at 100-year history of women and work, and breaks down those 100 years into 5 different segments of women. First, who just wanted to work, but then who wanted careers, and then who wanted families, and then who wanted both. And it's a really interesting evolution and really points out that, unfortunately, women have not been working and having families for that long of a period of time, that women often had to choose one or the other. And now we're at a place in time where we want both. We're getting both. There are struggles, but we're now in a different era of expectations. And so for all the young women out there, it's a really interesting read on the history, but know that it hasn't always been like this. And you're in a very fortunate period of time to make both happen for yourself.
Okay. Best way to unwind.
To give you two, and they're on the opposite sides of the spectrum. One is exercise and one is having a beer at the end of the day. As you can see, very different. But no, I'm a Peloton junkie. I really enjoyed that, especially during quarantine, and enjoy a lot of different forms of exercise.
Okay. What is one lasting piece of advice you would like to leave with our listeners?
I'm going to start with the people piece, which is pay attention to your networks and devote as much time to your networks and to building the people around you as you would to your actual job and what it is you're doing. Again, those networks are really going to serve you well throughout time. You never know when someone might be helpful to you. But by the way, keep them always warm so that when you need to speak with someone, you're not cold calling them after a long time asking for help, but you're maintaining great relationships over time that make it easier for you to go ask for help, and you'll feel less self-conscious about it and you'll feel good and confident about it. So focus on your networks And again, look for those sponsors around you. You know, another piece of advice, this one came from my father, and this might explain some of my early career choices. He would always tell me, really as a young kid, as a student, keep your options open. And I think what he always meant by that is do great work, be a good student, do what you have to do so that a lot of doors would open up to you. So you'd have the ability to do different things. And when it came to careers, he would also say that to me, get a number of different experiences in your career so that you can go a number of different ways. And I think that was great advice in my early career. I would say it probably wasn't the greatest advice mid to late career, because you can't keep dabbling in things. You have to pick a path at some point to go deep, to become an expert, to keep rising in your field. You know, generalists are great, and what we call athletes in the work world are great if you can do a lot of things. But at a certain point, particularly for women, I think it's really helpful to be an expert at something, to go very deep in something, to be known as the expert so that people come to you and you develop a real confidence in what it is that you bring to the table. So I will say, keep your options open and then pick a path and go deep into that path.
That is amazing advice. Sam, thank you so much for coming on this podcast.
Thanks, Jamie. Great to be with you.